the realization that something's going to change me and I can't resist it. If I want growth, if I want to see the world through a different lens, I need to sit into that, as uncomfortable as it is, sit in it and find a way to navigate that. That is tough, but it's part of the journey. Whether I'm facilitating or working alongside these senior executives, is that I've got a bank of what I call brave questions. So I'll give you one of my favorite questions that I've asked myself and I've asked all my clients this year.
Oh, go on.
And it's...
Welcome to the Mojo Podcast. I'm Richard Stokes. And in this season, we're exploring Mojo Under Fire, those crucible moments that either break us or forge us into the leaders others want to follow. Each episode, I sit down with people who faced their own defining moments, the crisis, the setback, the dark night, and found something unexpected on the other side. Not tips and tricks, but honest conversations about what it really takes to lead from the inside out. If you're looking for polish, this isn't it. If you're looking for truth, welcome. David McQueen works with CEOs and boards when decisions start to carry more consequence than certainty. He's someone who sits in rooms where the stakes are high, the information is incomplete, and there's no margin for error. In this conversation, we explore what Mojo means to a man who's built his career helping senior leaders navigate the crucible moments that really matter. David shares his thoughts on the courage it takes to evolve, why silence can be more powerful than words, and what it means to lead with humanity when the pressure's on. And on a personal level, David talks about the big decisions he's made in his life that have shaped his own leadership, with bravery always at the heart. This is a conversation full of wisdom, story, and many takeaways for you. I loved it. I hope you do too. Let's dive in. David McQueen, welcome to the Mojo Podcast. Great to see you.
And thank you for inviting me, Richard. A pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. And I always start here, David, intrigued at how you're doing today. How's your mojo today out of 10?
It's a good 7.5. It's a good 7.5. Yeah. I had to think about that before. Yeah. It's a good 7.5. It didn't start at 7.5, but right now it's about 7.5.
Okay. So it's maybe trending up.
Trending upwards, yeah.
Perhaps. And when I say that 7.5 comes to you very quickly, you get a good sense of where you're at with your mojo. What does that mean to you? What does mojo mean to you, David?
So the way I looked at it, and even when I was thinking about having this conversation with you, and I go, what the hell is my mojo? Like, when have I lost it? Where is it? I just think every day that we have an opportunity to live again. All right. I think we die once, but every day we get an opportunity to live again. And so what does that living again actually look like? And so when I think about my mojo, it's not so much about a motivation or an energy to do anything. I just think about it as around that attitude I have to living that day again. And so for me, when I think about the 7.5, there were a couple of things on my mind. There were people around me who had been affected by some things, and they were playing front and center of my mind. And then I took a step back from that, did a little bit of meditation, knew I was going to come to have the conversation with you. I've got a lunch later and a dinner this evening. And I was like, do you know what? I made it to today. So I'm incredibly grateful. So my mojo is this. It's almost like my appreciation to go, I'm here and I may not be flying on all cylinders, but I get to live another day. Let me live it to the best of my ability. And that's what I mean when I say my mojo 7.5.
Wow. I love that. You know, and I've been doing this for 6 years. And what I love is I always tend to get a different answer to that question. There's a theme, but that way you've gone with that is actually quite new. I got this sense of a reset opportunity. Yeah. And I got a lot about choice as well. Your choices. I start this day again. And with appreciation, I get a sense of gratitude as well for what can come, what I can create in this day. So, I love that.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
And just to support everyone that's watching, listening today, if they haven't maybe come across you on LinkedIn, which we'll talk about in a bit, but what would it be useful for people to know about you, David, as we embark on this short conversation today?
So I think first and foremost, I describe myself, it sounds weird when I say it sometimes, but I really like the label. I describe myself as a humanist. And by that, what I mean is that in my work and in my play, bang in the center of it is how do we really treat each other with respect and with regard for the fact that, as I said just to you just now, that we get an opportunity to live another day. What does it look like to be able to do that? And so I'm quite philosophical in the way that I see the world. I'm quite outspoken, quite provocative, not just for the sake of it, but because I really like people to think slightly different and, you know, just interrupt patterns. And so even when I think about my work, a lot of my work is specifically focused around leadership. And I would really say that I've really honed it down even more now to say, how do people make judgments based or decisions based on their judgment? What is that frame of judgment? And not in a negative way, because I don't necessarily think about it in terms of good or bad. But what is it that makes us, especially when we're in positions of leadership, be that business, be it personal, wherever that, and I'll talk about that a bit later, that frame of references. How, when we're making those decisions, are we really, what is it that's making us do that? What is it that's making us think, I want to make this decision, and regardless of the impact that it might have on someone else, what's the judgment that I'm using for myself to be able to do that? And so a lot of it for me is I look at a lot of the world philosophies, and even when I look at business philosophies and just the way that people operate, full stop, it always comes back to me like, what's the thinking that allowed us to go down this route? And so for me, my provocations are always around, okay, so you think that, and I think this. Okay, let's have a conversation about that, if it's possible. If not, that's fine. We can be totally different. But if we are going to have a conversation, let's have a conversation. And we don't have to convince each other to be right or wrong. But I find it just fascinating just to see, you know, what are the motives or what's the thinking behind what it is that you do? And that stuff, as I think my dad told me a number of weeks back, he said, you've always been nosy and curious and fascinated by people. And I'm like, okay, I'll take that to the bank. And that's always been a part of me. I've always been really curious. Like, I've been, you know, as kids, you know, they say kids always ask five whys. Why? Why did you do that? Why? I'm still that. I've not let that go. I've still got the five whys. I'm still going to go all the way. And so, yeah, a lot of curiosity around the human spirit and how we make decisions. And specifically in my work around leadership, that's how it manifests. But at the core of what it is, it's that human curiosity as to how we navigate the world.
Oh, I love that. And you know, your father's reflection on this has always been you. You know, I get this sense of I do get a sense of a playfulness actually.
Yes.
From you, with you already, a twinkle in your eye, and that kind of coming through. And when you were talking about, you know, having the conversations despite the differences, that almost feels, sadly, a bit countercultural right now, where people are taking positions and not having the conversations.
Yeah.
How are you, because I can tell that's important to you, how are you navigating that, or how are you encouraging people maybe to come back together?
Yeah, it's a part of it is recognizing that there's something powerful about being silent. There's something powerful about it. And what I mean by that is I don't think people should just keep quiet. That's very different. I'll make a difference between the two.
Yeah, nice.
But for me, silence is, all right, let me go with quiet first. Quiet for me is that you don't always have to respond to somebody when something comes up. So, you know, we're in a socio-political maelstrom, you know, 2025 as we're recording this, like the world looks like it's going to hell in a handbasket. And what has actually happened is there's so much technology and there's so much a demand for us to always have to react to what's actually happening. And sometimes I think we should be quiet and sit in silence and go, okay, how does this impact me? How does it impact the people around me, and what can I do about it? And the silence is more contemplative, where we can go and, you know, and if we then need to respond rather than react, I think that there's a response that comes afterwards or contemplate. That thing is important for me. But it's so noisy. It's so noisy that, you know, again, as I said, you discovered me on LinkedIn, and, you know, I made a conscious decision last year that I didn't care about who commented on my piece. I didn't care who reacted in a way. I just wanted it to just sit there and just sit and let it marinate. Mm. And that desire for people not to have to comment. And sometimes I will ask for a comment because, you know, if I'm in a discussion, but more often than not, I'm saying, I'm going to put something out there that people can really just sit with and then come and feedback. And the beautiful thing about that is that I've seen people sit in that silence and then just send me a DM. They've not put it online. They sent me a DM and they've come with some really comprehensive stuff. And we've had really good, I've ended up in companies and working with organizations just because of that reflection. And I'm not necessarily saying that it's there as a way to kind of like just go and get business, even though it is a business network, but it does give for me an opportunity. Silence is an opportunity for us to really contemplate as to how or why or what another person is thinking, ask better questions, and then be a bit more informed about how we move forward in our lives, full stop. So that's my kind of like my difference.
Yeah, sense. No, I love that distinction and the build of how quiet and silence can actually sit together. And again, you know, I said before, you were talking about, it was seemed quite countercultural, almost in the maelstrom of social media, if I use it generically.
Yes.
There's a lot of reaction, isn't there? Everyone's like, you know, or you can't say that, or I'm going to, you know, cancel you for this, or people coming with all sorts of language and energy to it. Whereas, again, what you're talking about there is create the space, the environment for a conversation, which I'm getting a sense allows people just to slow down and really respond, not react, and think about how do I want to engage with this. And you know, we'll move on to this you know, your book, Brave Leadership. In there, I'm already getting a sense of, because it's maybe a bit different, it feels to me anyway quite brave that this is how I'm going to show up in the world. And as you said, again, just earlier on about, you know, you are outspoken, you are provocative deliberately. And I think there's a lot of that kind of missing as well. So this has been a deliberate for you. This is how you want to appear in the world. This is how you want people to see you and understand you this way.
And again, it's not provocation for to just wind people up. It's more provocation to say, have you thought about this? Or if you are thinking in this way, challenge me on your point. That's absolutely fine. And the reason why I want the provocation is because I want it to be in a space where we can argue around the logic of something, to have a debate rather than just an argument. To look at the logic rather than just trying to force through an opinion based on emotion. So when I actually first started, I know we talk about the book, but when I first started writing the book, it came off the back of COVID and Black Lives Matter and so many other things that were happening at the same time. There was just like, you know, merging of worlds. And what I realized is that people were so polarized. You know, there were very few opportunities where somebody went, okay, do you know what? So you're going to take a vaccination here. This is the science that it's based on. This is what you believe is actually happening. Okay, bully for you. Or over here, someone going, I don't agree with the fact that they ran out vaccinations so quickly. How is the government able to respond to this? And there was never a space there were seldom spaces where there was a combination. You were either for or against. And it's the same thing that happened when the whole conversation came about around racial disparity, which was triggered off by Black Lives Matter. Again, there were individuals who felt that they just had to react to something. And it was really emotional, as opposed to what I call a response, which was a conversation to go, look, I don't understand this. And I remember, you know, for me personally, there were times where individuals were like, you know, David, I didn't realize that you were offended by X, Y, Z. I'm offended. I never said that I was offended. Ask me some questions and let's go and have a conversation. Let's go back and forth. And I wrote it because I felt, and so it's called basically The Brave Leader, More Courage, Less Fear, and Better Decisions for Inclusive Leadership. Mm. And that middle bit, the more courage, less fear, is that fundamental piece for me. It's getting individuals to recognize we don't have to always agree, but we can have a conversation. And when you're having that conversation, I want you to think about the decisions that you do make. Like, again, for example, you know, politically, there's this big thing around, you know, a religious obligation by some people to say, you know, they're anti-abortion for the sake of argument. And I say, okay, that's fine, but you can't make a decision on the law based on your religious beliefs if I, for example, am not religious. We can go back and forward on this stuff, but if that's what you're going to bring out and use as a principle, have you thought about the impact that it has on somebody who believes like me? And so we have these discussions where you realize that people can make decisions and people can impact people's lives without thinking through what that consequence actually looks like. And very often people are too afraid to have a conversation to say that they disagree. And for me, I'm like, I don't care what opinion that I have. If you disagree with me on that, I will fight to the death for you to hold that opinion to disagree with me. My only challenge comes with, and this is the bit that I really wanted to get with the book and the conversations that I have across the board, and it comes out to the point I made at the beginning about being a humanist. I've got no problem with having a difference of opinion with individuals, just as long as what you do and you believe and how you behave doesn't cause another person harm. Believe what you want. Believe absolutely what you want. But the moment it starts to cause harm to another person, that's when I'm really going to challenge you. And that's when I'm going to kind of like really go deep. So that's the kind of premise behind the bravery. I don't think enough people will say that. If you're going to cause someone harm, I'm going to say you're causing harm. I'm going to call you to account and I'm going to tell you that for me, I don't believe that's right. Let's have a discussion about it. I'm not going to fight you. I mean, unless you want to fight, but I'm not going to fight you, but we're going to have a robust conversation. And I think that some of the greatest innovations, the discoveries in philosophy, things that we have discovered in our lives have come because people have been going, right, let's test this idea. Let's see what goes wrong and let's see what goes right.
Mm.
But why not do that?
Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah, sort of a natural tension that creates something else, something bigger.
Yes.
Because you've had that disagreement, or you brought two different competing themes together, and then something's kind of emerged from it. And talk about emerging, you know, part of the theme of this series is looking at, you know, moments in guests' lives, careers, when there has been crisis, challenge, what I call, you know, the crucibles that we go through and come out differently. Where do you reflect on yourself for that? Has there been a defining moment for you when things have changed, or have there been maybe different periods of your life when you've noticed that?
I think there've been different ones. I literally, so weird, because I must have been a really weird kid, right? But I've always kind of like looked at my life in the cycles of the decades. So
yep.
Up until I was 10 till 20, 30. And you know, I was actually talking to my wife about this. So we've been married for 30 years now. And, you know, I was just talking about what I realized, how there are cycles that happen and there are moments of discomfort that come towards the end of the cycle. And interestingly enough, I'm heading towards this moment of discomfort as I head towards my sixth floor. I'm 57 this year, and you know, I'm heading towards 60. And there are some things that I'm really, honestly, Richard, I'm really batting up against philosophically, just the way that I want to work, where I want to live, and I look at all these stages in up until I was 20, and my 30s, and my 40s, and what have you. And every single one of those decades, something happened. You know, my 20s, I got married, had our first kid. In our 30s, we had young children. In our 40s, you know, we decided that we're going to step out on our business. 50s, our kids are getting older and we're starting to shape and do things slightly differently. And in all those journeys, I had to navigate different friendships. Some started, some ended. I remember in my 30s, I had a very strong, I was brought up as quite a strict, a Christian fundamentalist background, and in my 30s I went 360 on that and I became an agnostic. I was more humanistic in my way of thinking, and my wife and I, my wife is the youngest of six, I'm the middle of three, and we're the only ones in our family who are no longer religious. All of our siblings are religious.
Wow.
Navigating that, a lot of people don't talk about it, but you are the outsider. because the language, the behavior, the assumption, the culture is so wrapped up in that kind of, you know, thinking that how do you navigate that? And if we weren't the strong personalities that we were, that could have been really problematic for us and our children. And so to your point, I really look at all those stages and go, it's almost like a metamorphosis every 10 years that I have. And I really am okay with that. And sometimes there are people, when I've even met friends, they're like, you know, Dave, you've changed. And I'm like, I bloody well hope I have, because I don't want to be the, you know, at 57, I don't want to be the same person I was at 37 or 27. I want to be somebody different with experiences and life and seeing the way the world very differently. So I think the big thing for me, Richard, is that I've always either unconsciously, but more so consciously now, submitted myself to the realization that something's going to change me and I can't resist it. If I want growth, if I want to see the world through a different lens, I need to sit into that, as uncomfortable as it is, sit in it and find a way to navigate that. That is tough, but it's part of the journey, part of the journey.
Yeah, look at that. The level of awareness there, and I love this kind of the decade view and just the recognition that, yes, as you said, we are changing all the time. Yeah, as you said, often it can be the people around us who yearn for certainty and consistency, who have the you've changed kind of conversations. And again, coming back to something on the topic, there's sort of the bravery, the courage to acknowledge this change is very natural. In fact, as you said, the only place where growth actually lives is when we go through those levels of change. I love the metamorphosis metaphor, not least because the logo of my business is a butterfly, and recognizing that change. And in that metamorphosis, you know, the caterpillar, completely dissolves and rebuilds itself. It's that kind of level of change that we can go through. And we can go through, I think, as you're saying, when we're conscious about it and we, you know, I am making a choice here that there will be change. And I also recognizing it's not the easy road. This could be quite painful. I mean, when you share the story about, you know, the choice you and your wife made to not distance yourself, but to say, we are not following this Christian route anymore. This is the way we are and where we're going to bring up our kids. I can only imagine the challenge within the wider family must have been pretty intense.
Huge. Really huge. And I think a lot of people don't talk about it as much, but so much of your identity is wrapped up in a set of beliefs and a model of how you see the world, to literally be in a space where you go, right, I'm ripping that whole rule book up. And so when you see me, like I was explaining to my family, like when I get buried, I don't want a Christian funeral. And I know there are lots of people who were like, they can't process that, but I've had to write it down in my will that literally I'm having I want to celebrate and I want a humanist funeral. And a lot of people can't process that because their way of seeing the world and everything that has happened around them, this is the tradition, this is the ritual. And, you know, you made a really interesting point about your butterfly logo. So I'm a very keen gardener at the moment. You can tell I'm hitting my middle age, right? I'm very much into my garden. And one of the things that I was growing quite a lot of brassicas. So, you know, your cabbages and your cauliflowers and what have you. But they would get absolutely torn to shreds by caterpillars. Like, I mean, I'd have these huge heads, and then I'd come out one night and they would have just mullered my vegetables. And I was like, okay, I can't grow these because they're just ticking me off now and I can't do it. But one of the things that I realized, to your point, is I remember I've got a raised bed and I was, you know, clearing out and, you know, getting rid of the caterpillars, but it was at the point where they were metamorphosizing to turn into caterpillars. That thing is one of the most ugliest. When you see a butterfly is a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
But if you see what happens before, what you say, when that caterpillar goes to metamorphosize to become, that is one of the most painful, ugliest, horrible things that you see, actually, when you see the result and the remainder, you know, oh, but it's necessary for us to see that beautiful thing. And so in the same way, I go, Some of us don't like the ugliness. We don't like the ugliness. We only want to see the beautiful butterfly. But the beautiful butterfly was that caterpillar munching through the whatever the greens were before they were able to fly off and become this beautiful insect. And it's such a powerful reminder for us that sometimes we have to do the ugly before the beautiful shows up.
Yeah, and I love that. You know, that's it. Nature is our teacher, showing us so much. And just to almost pivot there a bit, David. So taking that and, you know, your experiences of change and choices you've made, decisions you've made, how are you taking that into the boardroom? You know, because I know you're working with CEOs,
yes,
leadership teams, boards, etc., high and very senior level. Obviously, the world today, if you set up, is, you might say, is you know, VUCA, volatile, uncertain, complex, ambiguous, all of that. And that can hamper decision-making and restrict a decision for making change. So how are you supporting the people you're working with in that, if you are seeing that sort of?
Yeah. So a big part of what I love about, although I mainly do advisory, so I tend to, while I'm doing the coaching, I tend to do more telling people. I'm not just going to sit down and ask you a question. I'm just going to go in there and tell you this is what you need to know, and then I'll ask you the tough questions. But a big part of what that looks like in whether I'm facilitating or working alongside these senior executives is that I've got a bank of what I call brave questions. So I'll give you one of my favorite questions that I've asked myself and I've asked all my clients this year. And it's, what truth about yourself are you avoiding because it would require you to change how you live? That, oh my gosh, like I asked myself the question and I'm like, and I can tell you honestly because I've written about it. My answer to that was my fear of rejection. I realized, and a lot of this came through therapy, that so many things I did in my business life and what have you, they were inbound because of my speaking, because of my presence, whatever. So much of it was inbound. But when I had to learn how to pick up a phone and do outbound sales and go to close a deal and what have you, the fear of rejection in the back of my head, I'd always have a backup plan. Always have a backup plan. So if they say this, well, that's all right. Not worried about it. I can kind of like go to the next. As opposed to, okay, that cut deep, but I need to move on to the next. And having to deal with that fear of rejection, which I actually believe that if there was one thing a lot of young people could learn in school would be around the fear of rejection. Mm. How do I deal with rejection? How do I bait that in from quite young? Because, you know, again, my parents, they came here from the Caribbean in the late 60s. And they came here, 20-somethings, came here, they dealt with a lot of stuff worse than I've ever had to deal with. And so for them, the passport for me and my brothers was to be as educated as possible, to speak the Queen's English better than the Queen, right? And to present in a certain way that would allow us to have the economic prosperity that they didn't necessarily have, but they had to work harder for. They just wanted us to be easier. But what that meant was that there was this incredible amount of pressure to almost be perfect. Mm. So, you know, I'd get an A minus for an essay, and my dad would ask me, well, where's the A? Right. Or I get 98%. What's wrong with the other 2%? Or people would tell me about my handwriting that it wasn't really, they couldn't read it really clearly. And so I spent all this time just writing. I went and got calligraphy pens and my hand. To this day, people say to me, your handwriting's so neat. I say it's born of trauma. that stuff came from trauma, right? And around perfection. But with that perfection, what it also meant is that I always was trying to avoid rejection. And so when I think about a lot of the boards that I work with, a lot of people don't make decisions because they're afraid of being unpopular. They're afraid of being isolated. They're afraid of not having been part of the consensus. Or sometimes what they will do is they'll flip it over to the other side and they will make a decision just because they just want to wind somebody up, as opposed to thinking around, how do I measure this through? And I guess one of the beautiful things about the work that I do is that I'm not emotionally attached to any of my client outcomes. I'm there as a sage, as a kind of like a what did somebody call me, the leading whisperer. So I can be a whisper in your ear to ask the difficult questions, but to do so with the intention that I'm a mirror. I'm holding the mirror up to you. You can't, when I'm asking you that, you can't run away. When I ask you that question, you know, what are you avoiding? That really kind of like puts you on the spot to go like, either I'm either not going to expose myself, or I have to be in that space to recognize that when I do it, it's not to make me feel weaker, but to make me go, all right, if this is stopping me from doing what I need to do, let me tackle it. Mm-hmm. So that, to your point, when I go into those spaces, the bravery for me is that I get to be, I was a former accountant. I was accountant for 8 years. After that, I worked in IT for 6 or 7 doing project management and rolling out and development. And then I went into leadership and personal development. But what I was able to do is bring my commercial experience into those boardrooms. So when individuals think that, oh, this guy's motivational, and I go, no, I can work my way around a P&L. All right, I know about your cap table. I know about your forecasts and your KPIs and your margins. And they're like, oh, we thought he was a motivational guy. And I'm going, like, I can motivate you, but this is not what I'm about. Because I can go in there and I can hold my head high around systems thinking, around coaching practices, around leadership development, around commercial, seeing through stuff through a commercial eye, it allows me to have that gravitas and ask those difficult questions. And to come full circle back, it allows me to go, and when you do that, and when you can answer those questions honestly, let's see how that raises your mojo. Thought I'd bring that background for you, Richard.
No, thank you. And love that. And I do get this, you know, when you were talking and that question, and it landed with me. I wrote down with shadow, and you talked about, you know, this is therapy. It's almost, this is, in a Jungian way, what is in my shadow? You know, what have I pushed down about myself that I don't like, that I don't want to expose? As you said, for you, you know, that fear of rejection being part of it. I have a fairly similar one, probably to that end. But, and then, you know, mapping where it comes from, and your awareness of that and sense of it, of okay. And I get this sense of your parents meant extremely well what they knew. They were, I'm supporting. And we know that sort of that sort of pressure to get that extra 2% can, that's going to have a half-life of its own. It's going to sit there until we take responsibility and kind of deal with some of that. So, you know, love that. And also this, you know, I get a sense of the leaders you're working with and who bring you in, that, you know, this is also the way you're working is probably the path least trodden, because this is asking a lot, you know, of them to get to that level of depth, not exist on the surface of, well, we're just going to paste some values to the wall and all would be good. I'm getting a sense of you and your expertise, wisdom, style is taking them to a depth as they go.
Yeah. And I think that depth thing is where we just really find ourselves. It's so interesting. I think you do something similar, and please forgive me if I'm speaking out of turn here, but the majority of my senior leaders are men. And so when I am at that level, the majority of C-suite individuals I'm working with are men. And although I'm a trained therapist, I don't practice as a counselor. One of the things you realize again is you can see resistance. You can see people not wanting to step into shadow. You can see how individuals are going to put up walls or barriers to kind of like say, this is my protective shield.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons why I tend to ask these questions is I'm saying, look, while I'm here, I'm creating a space of psychological safety. And what that means is, as I want you to feel comfortable enough to have the conversation in this space to know that you're supported. And the reason why I do that is because way too many men are in positions of political, business, or civic leadership. And they're making decisions and they don't necessarily have the honesty of other men to fall back and go, do you know what? I don't have the answers. Or I've really screwed up here. Or I'm really suffering at this point in time and I don't know what it is. And so where do I go? And then they're the outlets, right? We have the alcohol, the sex, the bravado, you know, as opposed to let me just sit in this for a minute and recognize that I don't have the answers, but I can tap into people who are around me. And that bravery for me is being able to say to a lot of the men that are in those spaces, it's okay. It's actually okay. You know, I specifically don't put, like, even when I've got testimonials in my, on my site, I specifically don't put try not to put names of people, because I know most of the men who I've coached have cried. They were not crying when they're with me. Because when I ask a question like that, and you've got to, that goes in, no matter how much you resist, that stuff is going in. And then, you know, and I'm saying to him, like, don't feel afraid because you cry. You don't have to pretend not to, if you've got to cry, cry. That's a release. Get it out of the system, get it out. And for me, that I say to people, if you cry in front of me, that says to me, you trust me, because you're not holding it back. So that bravery for me, and that bit to your point around being in those spaces, in those boardrooms or with those senior leaders, is going, okay, do you know what? You can have some of the answers. You don't need to have all of them. Double down on the ones that you have some of, and then find a way to tap into others who have some of the other answers, and we'll make it work. But be brave enough to recognize that you don't have all the answers. I'm going off on a tangent now, but I've recently written this series of posts called The CEO's Toolkit. And what I say, a lot of people who get put into roles of CEOs go in and no one's really nurtured them as to some of the things that they need to have. And so I've, you know, got some people get dropped in to steady the ship. Some people get brought in to grow. Some people realize that they founded it and they shouldn't be the CEO, or they need to be coached to go into that space. And very often there isn't a toolkit. Very often there aren't things. I'm like, well, if you're going to go, you know, if you're flying a plane, like, you better have done a couple of hours. You better understand what it looks like to fly that plane. But very often there are individuals in there, and I can't tell you the amount of times I've coached technical founders who don't know their way around a financial sheet, P&L's balance sheet, cash flow. And I'm like, you've got a £40 million company and you do not know your way around a financial statement. We need to take that back. But because there is the bravado or the fear of doing that, I go, no, let's be brave about this. If you don't know it, let's sit down. We'll have a conversation and I'll walk you through what that actually looks like. Or you don't know the marketing piece. You don't have to know all the answers, but whoever you hire, at least you know how to be literate with that individual. And so I wrote that series to go, sometimes you just need that toolkit and sometimes you might be too afraid to ask, but let me at least put something out there so you have it as a resource that you can go to. Mm-hmm. Again, that's the bravery then, is not about denying it. It's going, okay, well, let me take the leap and go and look at it and explore it. That makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. That sense of taking that first step. I often talk, and I do a lot, as you say, a lot of men's work in groups individually. And I kind of use the metaphor of the swimming pool, and men tend to come to the edge of the pool. Yeah. Oh, that looks nice. That looks really, oh, cool me down. And they're just about to jump in. And then it's, oh, but hang on, no, I'll get wet. If I jump in that pool, I'm going to get soaking wet. And that is really inconvenient right now. I can't be doing that. And that's when you see men kind of pull back from that kind of edge I'm kind of talking about. Whereas, you know what you're talking about with empathy and with skill, you can lead men, as we're talking about specifically here, through that process of letting go of some of this weight. And when you were talking, I go, that weight on the shoulders, whether you're CEO, whatever leader, just bringing it all on and not having a sense of safety to say, I haven't got all the answers. Because we know for the masculine, humiliation is the greatest fear.
Yeah.
So if that is the greatest fear, then I am not going to put my hand up and say, I don't know the answer, unless we get the support of a great coach like yourself and maybe even me. But that's, you know, that feels like a huge opportunity for men. And kind of we're kind of in this territory now that it feels there's a time where, and I know, you know, you do a lot of work in the DEI space generically, but there's a time for men putting their hands up and saying, yeah, can I have some support here too?
100%. 100%. If I was, there's one of the things I was saying when I got brought in a number of years ago in organizations, especially when they were really struggling to navigate race, I said, look, I'm a leadership guy. Race is not I can come in with my lived experience, but my lived experience is going to tell you how to run the business, but I can have an honest conversation.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I kept on saying was, do you know what? I'm not going to lambast what is predominant in the UK, white middle class men in boardrooms. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to have a conversation because that's not how you win the battle. And do you know what's really interesting, Richard? I have literally approached so many organizations and said, I will come in and I will work with men. And the amount of resistance, I'm talking about in corporate, I'm talking about in the civil service, I'm talking about in so many spaces, the amount of resistance to the point where I've just gone, you know, I'm not going to wait on that anymore. And what I've done eventually is I've off my main page, I have dinners. I literally will get, like tonight, I've got dinners, 10 men. This one specifically for men of African and Caribbean descent. Who I've like, we're going to have dinner. Everybody come in, you chip in a certain amount. We're going to sit down. We're going to have a space and we're just going to talk about life. I have another one coming up, which is predominantly about with male senior leaders. And this is predominantly white male men. And it's just around how are you navigating a lot of the choices and the changes that are being made in the world. And I literally have had to go to men as individuals because for organizations, they just haven't accepted that. And I'm like, but these are the guys at the top. You think they're okay? These are the ones who you're like, oh my God, I didn't know he had anxiety or depression. I'm like, well, I could tell you a mile off that was there. We could see things. And it's such a shame to your point that this is one of the bugbears I had when a lot of people were pushing programs around DEI. I was like, make sure that you include white men in that. And not in a negative way, but to the point where if you're going to say that we're looking across the board, yes, there are pockets of power and what have you, but if you're running the show and I want you to be able to understand how a woman goes through menopause or a first generation African person will come in and try to anglicize their name or somebody who is non-heterosexual, I need to talk to you who's doing the making the decision and the power at the top. If I don't get that, you'll just feel that you're being marginalized and you won't feel part of the team. But the sad thing, again, as I say, and I've written about it, I've spoken about it, is that there are too many individuals in organizations who don't think that's a group that should be dealt with. And I think it's wrong. And I think rather than waiting for the organizations to do it, I've just reached out to men, and at least twice a month, sometimes maybe three times, I'll grab, and I know men love food, right? So we'll sit around a table and we'll have food and we'll have that camaraderie and I'll go, let's do it that way. That makes sense.
Yeah, no, completely. No, I hear everything you're saying about the some of the barriers that kind of corporates are putting up to that work. And I love that all right, I'm going to go create the space then, you know? I run a few men's groups. I do a breakfast, actually, there's the food thing, and then a few on Zoom as well. But that camaraderie, that coming together, yes. I think that's a big part of the missing element for men, specifically, again, to the masculine energy of being quite isolationist, focused, I'll just kind of manage through this thing, versus maybe the feminine energy, which is more of that connective piece that kind of goes on. And yet when men come together, I bet they all say after that dinner, like, oh, why don't we do this more often?
All the time.
Why are we not doing this all more often?
Yeah, all the time.
Let's book it in. David, I wanted to, again, shift gears slightly because I want to talk about your public speaking. Because I know you're a renowned public speaker globally. And I just want to get into a sense of, again, from a Mojo point of view, what that takes to get up on a stage in front of hundreds, probably thousands of people sometimes, deliver something, and then kind of, you know, how you feel afterwards as well. Because often when I've done public speaking, it's definitely not my number one skill, but I'll have some nervousness beforehand. I'll do it, maybe enjoy it. And then afterwards, I might be the old mind and be going, oh, did I really land it? Maybe a little bit of a doubt can then set in. So what supports you, I suppose, is the question. What supports you to be your best self when you are kind of on stage?
So two things. The first one is I realized that for years and years of speaking, no matter how much I felt about something on a stage, one person feeding back to me how it made them feel is priceless, absolutely priceless. And I've been in spaces and on stages where I thought, with my own self-critical mind, oh my God, did that land? Or I've had five things to say and I only did two. So there's a self-war. I wanted to give them the other five. And somebody comes up to me afterwards and goes, do you know what? I really, really love your honesty. And that actually just made my day and gave me permission to do X. Getting that back, whether I've done it in a huge tech conference somewhere or whether I've spoken in-house for a group of people in staff, that feedback has been priceless. Do I get nervous? I still get nervous. But for me, I always say the moment I stop getting nervous, I should never go on the stage, because that means if I'm way too comfortable, something's not right. I've got to still have that energy. I'm serving that audience. But the second part for me is that as I've gotten older, and I'd say this really struck me in the last 6 or 7 years, is that I enjoy more small group delivery now than being on the big stage. And the reason being is because don't get me wrong, I love being in that space. You know, I did stand-up comedy for a little bit. I've learned all these different Alexander technique. I learned all these different ways of being able to communicate to a big audience. But there's something about being in a room of 12 to 20 individuals who can really have a dialogue with you around what they're doing or where their leadership is at and what they can do next. And being able to walk away from that, knowing that tangibly, even if it's two of those 12, that they can take that thing and make it work. For me, I find that a lot more rewarding now than standing in front of a huge audience, learning my comic timing, making people smile, changing, you know, what have you. Because again, it's an hour in somebody's life that can make a difference, and I'm never going to take away from that. But what I do realize is when I'm doing my masterclasses or when I'm doing facilitating executive sessions, those ones for me tend to be more lasting, because I feel that it's a great indicator of somebody learning that stuff and going, okay, I'm going to go and put this in action. And that for me is priceless. That is absolutely priceless. So I love that. And I still get nervous around it, and I'm still learning. I'm always learning. I'm always crafting. I will always watch. And like, whenever I see other people speak, I'm always in the audience going, I'm going to be a student of that person. I'm never there to critique them. I'm like, what can I learn from you? What did you do there? Oh, what did you do on that slide? Oh my God, I saw that bit of comic timing. Oh, I realized the way they paused and really reflected there. That was quite, and I would go, ooh. So I'm a lifelong student of public speaking. I don't care who it is. I will always sit down and I will learn from them. So that's my kind of approach to it.
No, I love that. And I think, you know, there's often bits that people feedback to me, they take out of the podcast because it is quite, you know, tangible, either a support and advice. And there's two things in there. Nerves are natural. Expect them. It's how you handle them. And then that always developing, always learning, that humility there. I think that was because I think there is, back to a bit of what we were talking about earlier, this sense of I get on stage, I must be perfect. I must be so perfect. And then, you know, do you actually do this 100% full time for a living? Chances are you won't. I don't even know what perfect is, by the way, in that.
Yeah.
You know, we are where we started. We are human, and you're going to feel things and you're going to experience things in a certain way. David, amazing. I've loved the conversation. I want to leave you with one nice open question to finish with everything that we kind of covered. I'd love to know what, and with, through whatever lens you want to put this, actually, this question. What are you hopeful about for the future?
Oh, I love that. I am hopeful that regardless of the doom and gloom that people come with technological advances like AI and what have you, I'm hopeful that there will still be a lot of creativity, that there will still be a lot of individuals who, whether it's in their work or their play, will continue to be creative. Will bring out fabulous podcasts, will bring out paintings and fine art, will bring out great music. And that even though it seems like things are shifting, kids will still run out into parks and play and jump in the mud and in a puddle and create sand castles and all the rest of that. I'm hopeful that although it's very easy to be sidetracked by messages of doom and gloom, when we're left to our own resources as humans, we can be incredibly creative and we can continue to create stuff. And that I take hope in that. I take open mind. I'm not one of those doomsayers that thinks that it's the end of the world now because of Instagram and OpenAI and all the rest of it. Yeah, they're a portion of it, but there's a lot of people in the world who don't go anywhere near those things and who have no idea what they are, and they will still be in a corner somewhere creating something. So I'm really hopeful for the creativity of mankind. And I guess the other bit as well is that I, even though there are a lot of political and business leaders who are quite dominant in the way that they see the world, I actually believe for the 7 billion of us who are here, most of us are just quite simple, just want to get on with each other, have a nice little laugh, eat some really good food, drink some drink and be fine. And I'm hopeful that that will continue.
Beautiful. I mean, I love the loop on that, because where we started, you talked about importance of playfulness, I think, to you and what you're about, and then bringing it all the way back to that answer. So, well, David, I've absolutely loved this conversation. You know, meeting someone who you sort of, I sort of think I know a bit about him from, you know, the 2D of LinkedIn, and really getting to understand you way more. Really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for joining the Mojo podcast today.
Thank you. And thank you for having me. And I thank you for your questions. A real honor to be here. Thank you.